left airlock. "You will, though," Naomi said. "Test the people you trust, too. Make it random. And make it so that someone can keep eyes on you. It's like checking the seals on your suit. Everyone checking everyone should just be normal. And be ready for the crackdown, because it's coming." Chava sipped her own coffee and nodded. "I wish you were staying. I mean, it'll be nice to be able to invite my friends over to my place again, but I've enjoyed having you here. Even though it risked getting you killed?" Chava was one of those people who could frown with just her forehead. "Maybe because of that. I think I'm too much of an adrenaline junkie to survive as a ship rental manager. If it wasn't this, I'd be slingshotting on my vacations." Naomi finished her coffee, put down the white porcelain cup for the last time, and hugged Chava goodbye. Naomi's belongings were in a tight-wrapped bag by the door. They fit easily under her arm. She looked around Chava's rooms one last time. The kitchen, the common area, the passage to the bedroom that had been hers for really not so long a time. Still, long enough for everything to change, at least twice. The knot she felt in her chest wasn't sorrow at leaving here. She liked Chava, and it was a pleasant space to be in, but it wasn't home. What she missed was the idea of a home of her own. People she knew for more than a few weeks at a time. It was worse because she'd had a place once, and a family with it. She would never stop missing that. The transport tubes on Oberon's lunar base ran cars every 7 minutes, and the signs and directions were clear and well-designed. It wasn't hard getting from Chava's place to the docks, or from the docks to the skiff taken out in a false name tied to an imaginary corporation and insured with a policy that would never be used. Oberon was a target, and not only because it was a successful colony. Any Laconian traffic analysis of the bottles the underground used was going to show high throughput on the Oberon gate. With the Tempest dead, there would be a response. And neither she, nor Chava, nor any of her other high-level contacts doubted that part of that response would come to Oberon. And the best way to survive an asteroid strike was not to be on the planet. While she waited for the traffic control queue to reach her, she opened a window and called up the visual telescopy on the planet below her. Another blue marble in the void. The wide whirl of a hurricane covered part of an ocean she'd never see. The scattering of continents across the visible hemisphere below her was like dice thrown in a backroom craps game. A vast, beautiful sphere with so few people on it. Cities with universities full of students who'd never known a different sky. She doubted she'd ever see it again. And so she watched and told herself to remember. There were so many last times that passed unrecognized. Knowing in the moment what was ending and wouldn't come again was precious. The connection to traffic control went live. "Skiff 1842, your transit to Baragaun is approved. You are clear to exit." "Acknowledge, control. Releasing the clamps now." The little ship, light as an empty food can, shuddered when the docking clamps let go, and Naomi opened the throttle on the drive. The image of Oberon grew a little smaller, and a little smaller, and a little smaller until she closed it down. The moment was over. The skiff was a tiny little thing, too small and undistinguished for a name. A transponder code, a number, and a perfunctory paper trail. It was as cramped as a racing ship, but without the maneuverability or high-end crash couch. It was intended for in-system trips, usually between planets in similar orbits. Taking it into the depths of the system, through the ring, and then back down some stellar gravity well, meant traveling well outside its intended use. Naomi didn't find it intimidating. She'd gone much farther and much worse in her life. After a few days' hard burn, she went on the float. She spent the hours double-checking the system, such as it was, making sure the air mix was where it should be, the reactor bottle, the water tanks. Knowing everything about her little bubble of air and life was comforting. If she caught a micrometeorite, it would be too late to learn. So she did it now. Prepare for the worst, and be pleasantly surprised. The skiff didn't have a gym, but she still had her resistance bands from her life in the shell game. She could adapt. She always did. She also found herself imagining conversations with Saba, and with Jim, and Bobby, and Alex. There were strategic decisions she was going to have to make. Bobby's victory put Duarte on his back foot. With only a single Magnetar-class ship left, there was a chance for the Underground to drive Laconia into a purely defensive posture, even restricted to its own system. It would mean making a real and credible threat on Laconia itself, but it was possible. But it wasn't enough. There had been a time when the Transport Union and the government of Mars and Earth had expected Laconia to be like any other colony world, struggling for base survival and aiming for self-sustaining agriculture sometime in a generation or so. But Duarte had taken the protomolecule with him along with the expertise to use it, and he'd found the construction platforms that could build ships like the Tempest and the Storm, and apparently a way to create and bottle antimatter. A threat wasn't enough. She had to find a way to break that manufacturing capacity. If Laconia fell, it had to fall hard. It had to know that its dream was over, that it wasn't exceptional. Once it was broken down to the same level as other worlds, it could be brought back, reintegrated. Because that was the trick. That was the deep lesson of the Belters and the Inner Planets, the OPA and the Transport Union. It was the single central argument that the universe had made to her through her whole life, and she was only now seeing it clearly. Wars never ended because one side was defeated. They ended because the enemies were reconciled. Anything else was just a postponement of the next round of violence. That was her strategy now, the synthesis of her arguments with Bobby, the answer she wished they'd found together when they were both alive. Once she reached Baragaon, the other major success among the colony worlds, she'd have to get a sense of what warships she could muster and the transit times. If there was a way to lure Duarte's forces out away from Laconia's system and then push in when their home fleet was spread thin, there might be a way. She was still thinking about that, imagining what Saba or Bobby or Jim might think when she started the braking burn. The bottle from Sol's system passed through the Oberon Gate just a few hours after that. The skiff captured the encrypted data, just the way Hava's system would do back on the planet's moon. It took half a day to finish unpacking, so hours passed before she heard Alex's voice again, and knew what they'd lost in order to win. He looked not older. He didn't look old. Or tired. She'd seen him look tired before. He looked diminished, like the grief had taken some of the color from his eyes.
"So, it turns out I'm done here," he said in his private message to her. "I got this young guy I've been training up should be able to take over. We're heading for our little dry dock. You know the one."
Even in three layers of encryption, Alex wouldn't say the word freehold.
"When we get there, I'm stepping out. I thought I might go check on the old girl, make sure nothing's been making a nest in her. After that, I don't know. I guess that's your call, since you're running the show now. I don't want to take her out unless you're good with it. You and me are the only ones left now. So, Yeah. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to let Bobby go.
Don't apologize to me, Naomi said to the screen. Her tears made lenses over her eyes. Oh, sweet man, don't apologize for this.
But the message was done, and the passage through the ring gate was almost upon her. She passed into the slow zone with a heaviness that didn't have anything to do with the rate of her change of velocity. It was her first transit since they'd lost Medina, and Saba, and the model of human civilization that she'd understood. The station at the center of the ring was glowing bright as a little star, still shedding the energy it had absorbed from the gamma burst. The surface of the ring space, which had been a featureless blackness, danced with twisting auroras that were weirder and more threatening than the dark had been. What scared her more, though, were the ships. She had expected the space to be empty. After everything that had happened, she'd thought traffic between the gates would be close to nothing. She'd been wrong. Her little skiff picked up transponder signals for almost 24 ships, and drive signatures for more than that. The Laconian directive that the ring space be kept clear was being ignored on a scale she hadn't understood, and the raw danger of it took her breath away. With no Medina station to control the passages, the chances of going Dutchman were much worse than they should have been. She'd made her transit in distraction and ignorance, and she could have vanished and never known why. And that was assuming that the event that killed Medina and the typhoon, that had destroyed 2 of the gates in the network, hadn't changed the rules. If the threshold for vanishing was different now, they wouldn't know. Not without testing it. Maybe it was the need for supplies on the vulnerable colonies, or the chance to deliver goods without paying the Union. Maybe it was that humanity, given freedom, forgot about the prospect of consequences. Whatever the drive, it took her breath away. It was such a shock that she didn't notice at first that 2 of the ships were Laconian warships, like the gathering storm, or that they were burning toward her. In the mess of the traffic and her own internal chaos, she didn't see that until the skiff got the connection request from the monsoon. Her system had the software to disguise her voice and appearance, and she checked 5 different times that it was running before she accepted the request.
"This is Chief Petty Officer Norman of the Monsoon," the man on the screen said. "You are in violation of quarantine. Please leave the ring space immediately."
His voice had the irritated sing-song of someone reciting a hated ritual.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I didn't mean to. It's just that my brother's sick. I was supposed to be back with him weeks ago. I don't have any contraband, I swear."
"I don't care where you go," the Laconian said. "Just get out of here and stay out. There will be a permanent force in here soon, and this kind of thing will get people shot. Be somewhere else when that happens."
"Yes, sir," she said. "I'll transit out right away, sir."
The connection dropped. They were swamped. More than that, they had ships in the slow zone that weren't stopping to control the space. That meant they either understood the risks and were keeping their exposure to a repeat of the catastrophe that had killed Medina Station and the typhoon to a minimum, or they had bigger fish to fry, or both. And she saw as she tracked their courses, the Laconian destroyers were heading for Oberon.
"You came close," she said softly, "but no cigar."
The Baral Gown Gate was on a secant that cut her passage through the ring gate to almost half what the maximum distance would have been. The gate wasn't quite where the navigation system expected it to be. The loss of the Tanjavur and Tacoma gates had shifted all the others just the smallest bit, but enough to make the software care about it. She went to correct the course manually, and paused.
"My brother's sick," she thought, "and so am I."
She corrected the skiff's course, aiming it for Freehold, and for home. Chapter 36. Teresa. The day Teresa finally broke began like most days now, with a nightmare. She had been awake until the small hours of the morning, watching old movies and entertainment feeds that she'd seen before, trying to squeeze comfort out of them because they were familiar. Knowing what was going to happen before it happened made the stories feel very safe, not at all like her real life. She stayed awake as long as her body would let her, and when she could stay awake not one moment longer, the dreams came for her all at once, like they'd been waiting for her, like they were hungry. There were three main varieties. In the first, she was in a strange part of the state building, and her father, or sometimes her mother, was in a room nearby being killed, and she could stop it if she found the right doorway. In another, the planet Laconia had gotten a disease of some kind, and bits of the land had started falling down deep into the burning core. Nothing was stable, and nothing was safe. The third was formless and violent, less a dream than variations on Illich's murder of Timothy. Each version came regularly enough that she'd begun to recognize them. The dreams had even started commenting on it. As some new terror reared its head, she'd think, "It's just like in my dreams, only now it's really happening." It made the nightmares worse because it made them feel inevitable. Her waking hours were poisoned by them. The violence and fear and loss could spill out at any moment, from any place, and nothing could be relied upon. It was terrible because it was true. She woke after not enough sleep to the gentle tapping of a servant and muskrat's excited bark. Breakfast was a favorite meal for the old dog. Maybe every meal was. The servant brought in a white ceramic tray with a plate of eggs and sweet rice, a glass of watermelon juice, and a sausage with the dark, grainy mustard that she liked. Or that she had liked. Food wasn't something that interested her now. Not the way it used to. She stirred the sweet rice and watched the official news feeds talking breathlessly about the Laconian ships offering assistance to local governments in the ongoing fight against separatist violence. Images of men and women in Laconian formal blues talking seriously with the governors of Earth and Mars. She wondered if anyone believed that. She wondered whether she had. She knew that if she didn't eat, her failure would be reported to Trejo. It had happened before. She took a bite of egg, but the rubbery texture of the white made her gag. The rice would be enough. It had to be. She hadn't been able to get more than half of her dinner down the night before. She knew that starving wasn't good for her, and that Illich and Trejo wouldn't like it. That was part of why she did it. She took a spoonful of the rice, sucked away the thick, sweet sauce, and spat out the grains. On her screen, Admiral Gujarat was talking about the completion of the Whirlwind, the newest Magnetar-class ship, as if it weren't the only one, as if the first two weren't already dead. She picked the sausage up. The smell of grease and salt was repulsive. She couldn't see it as anything but a slurry of dead animals in a thin membrane. She tossed it to Muskrat. Instead of wolfing it down, her dog looked from the scrap to her and back again, and whined. "You might as well," Teresa said. "I wasn't going to eat it before. I'm certainly not going to now." Muskrat swung her wide tail twice, uncertainly. She ate the sausage with something that looked like shame. Teresa's numbness slid away for a moment, and tears came to her eyes. The state building was filled with people from every system in the Empire. She had people whose only duty was to cook her food, to educate her, to see that her clothes were cleaned and put away. Nobody had the job of actually caring about her. The only one who even noticed her was a dog. A voice spoke in the back of her head, as clear as if there had been someone in the room. It sounded like her own, but calmer, drier, somehow more adult than she thought of herself, like some later Teresa, sending a stray observation back through time. Muskrat likes Holden. The voice didn't go on. Teresa looked down at Muskrat's complicated brown eyes, and the sorrow lost its edge. You may have shitty taste in friends, she said. Sorry, dog. Another tap came at her door, and she didn't need to open it to know it was Illich. She stirred her food to make it look like she'd eaten more than she had and let the door open. As soon as he saw her, his smile faltered. I know, she said before he even spoke. It's very important that we maintain the image that everything is normal. You tell me that every day. She stood up and put her arms out to the side. This is normal. I'm normal. Of course, he said with a practiced smile that meant he just wasn't going to fight her. Your peer class is going to start soon. Dr. Okoye is going to be leading it today so that I can meet with Admiral Trejo. So that I can do something more important, he meant. Even if he didn't say the words, Teresa heard them. Muskrat huffed and wagged her tail, anticipating the adventure of leaving her rooms. Teresa shrugged and walked toward the door, daring Illich not to step aside. He stepped aside. The state building was the same as it had ever been. The archways, the colonnades, the gardens, nothing about it had changed. It was her home and her kingdom, and somehow they'd made it into her cell. Illich and all the others, too. She was honored and revered and treated with total deference if she did what she was told, when she was told. Her opinion was listened to with seriousness and gravity, and then ignored. She stalked toward the lecture room, wondering what would happen if she marched in, took the microphone, and shouted, "My father is brain dead and nothing is all right." It was enough to make her smile. As it turned out, though, the fantasy wouldn't have worked. The lecture room had been rearranged for the day. 6 slate-topped tables stood in rows of 3. The other students, her so-called peers, were already there. Apparently Illich had come because she'd run late and hadn't noticed. The room stank of something deep and caustic. Air recyclers were set up in all the windows, scrubbing whatever the volatiles were out and blowing fresh air back in. Small trays sat on each table, 2 each, with a variety of scalpels, tweezers, pins, and thin scissors laid out between them. Elvie Okoye was walking among the students, leaning on her cane and chatting as she went. Teresa felt her anger shift again. She was supposed to be fixing Teresa's father, not teaching classes to a bunch of kids. But, of course, Teresa wasn't allowed to say that, because that wouldn't look normal. "Good to see you, Teresa," Elvie said and touched her hand. "I'm glad you're here." Teresa shrugged and moved away, leaning against one of the tables. Now that she was close, she could see the bodies spread out in the trays and held down with pins, dead animals, dead as Timothy, dead as her mother, dead as all the people in the ring space. "So today, Colonel Illich wanted me to, give you all a little introduction to parallel evolution. So what we have here are 2 different species from 2 different trees of life. One of them is native to Laconia, and the other one's from Earth. They're both called frogs, because they fill the same ecological niche, and because they have some similarities in anatomy. So, yeah, get in groups of 3, I guess, and I'll walk you through the dissections." Teresa looked at the frogs. They both had pale bellies and darker skin, though the one she recognized was considerably darker. The rear legs folded differently, and one had 2 forelimbs to the other's 4. From where she was standing, the thing they had most in common was that they were dead. She took a scalpel between her fingers, considering the blade, and wondered whether she'd be able to cut the bodies open without vomiting. The upside was she didn't have much in her belly to puke up, so that was fine. "Hey," Connor said. She hadn't seen him come up, but here he was, sandy hair and soft eyes. She remembered caring what his opinion was. She remembered wanting to kiss him like it was in a film she'd watched, and not something she'd felt herself. She pinched the flat of the blade between her fingers and held the handle out to him. "Want to cut?" she asked. He took it and looked away, uncomfortable. That was fine. Sean Ellison made up the third of their group. When all the rest had formed up, Elvi Okoye opened a volumetric display with an image of two idealized frogs to match the ones on their trays. "Okay," Elvi said. "So one of the things that we see in both Laconia and Earth biomes is water. And there are animals that have found an advantage to living part of their lives in the water and part out. We call them amphibians. Both of your frogs are amphibians. And because water is chemically identical in both worlds, and the adult forms that we have here need to breathe air, there are some problems they both faced as they evolved. Some solutions look very similar, and some of their strategies could not have been more different. So let's start with looking at the Earth frog's lungs. Each team should make the first incision right here." Slowly, step by step, they began unmaking the frogs. Despite herself, Teresa found the process interesting. The way the Laconian frog cycled water in and out of its chest cavity to do the work that the Earth frog did with the diaphragm. The way the feeding mechanisms, mouth and esophagus for the Earth frog, chambered mouth and gut for the Laconian, served the same functions in different ways. She felt like it was all telling her something deeper than just biology. Something about herself and the people around her. Something about whether she could ever belong. She realized she had been drifting off when Connor spoke to her again. His voice was quiet and tentative. "My mom." Teresa glanced up at Elvi. She was across the room talking to one of the other groups. "What about her?" Teresa asked. "I was just saying that my mom, she's, you know, she watches the news feeds with everything that's going on." He glanced at her, and then away like he was shy, like he was saying something shameful. Sean Ellison didn't speak, but watched with the intensity of someone expecting violence. It felt illicit and strange, like he'd said the first part of some password and she didn't know the rest. Then, a heartbeat later, she did. He was asking her to tell him something reassuring. His parents were scared. He was scared. And because they were in peer class together, and she was her father's daughter, he wanted her to tell him that everything was going to be all right. That she, knowing what she knew, wasn't afraid, and that he shouldn't be either. She licked her lips and waited to see what would come out of them. "She shouldn't spend too much time on them," Teresa said. "I know everything looks really scary, but it's not that big a problem. Dad has the best minds in the Empire working for him, and they're learning more every day. Everyone always knew there'd be setbacks." "Yeah," Connor said. "Everyone knew." So she'd lied. That was interesting. She'd told him what he wanted to hear, and it wasn't even because she wanted to protect him or keep him safe. It was just easier. She understood now why adults lied to children. It wasn't love. It was exhaustion. And she was like them now. They'd eaten her. "Are you okay?" Sean asked, and it seemed like her voice was closer than she was. Like the girl wasn't talking from across the table, but whispering into Teresa's ear. It sounded soft and weirdly intimate. "I'm fine," Teresa said. Only the words didn't come out. She had the sense that she needed to leave now, that if she could get a drink of water and lie down for a minute, her breath wouldn't seem so loud in her ears. She felt herself walking. At the door, someone's arm appeared beside her, startling her. It was her own. She moved the hand, fascinated by her control of it, married with the absolute emotional certainty that it wasn't her arm. Elvie Okoye was there too, like something from a dream. She said something, asked something, but before Teresa could answer, she'd forgotten what it was. I wonder if I'm dying, Teresa thought. And the idea wasn't unpleasant. For a while, Teresa lost herself. A flurry of sensory impressions, voices, movement. Someone was touching her hands and her neck. A bright light shone in her eyes. When she came back, she was lying down. The room was familiar, but until she heard voices she knew, she couldn't quite place it. I'm not drawing any conclusions, the doctor said. It wasn't Dr. Cortázar. It was her old pediatrician, Dr. Klein, and he was talking to Elvie Okoye. What I'm saying is she's dehydrated and malnourished. Maybe she got that way because there's some kind of uptake problem. Maybe she's had an allergic reaction to something, or her stress levels are so high she's somatizing. Or, and I'm just saying maybe here, she's been starving herself. She was in the state building's medical wing, on a gurney. There was a line connecting an autodoc to a vein at the back of her hand. When she shifted, she could feel the needle under her skin and the coolness in her arm where it was feeding fluid into her. I skipped breakfast, Teresa yelled, and her voice sounded normal again. It's my fault. It was stupid. I just lost track of time. They were at her side before she finished speaking. Dr. Klein was a youngish man with wavy brown hair and green eyes that reminded her of Trejo. She liked him because he'd given her sweets after her checkups when she was young, and because he'd never condescended to her. Now he was looking at the system readout from the autodoc and trying not to meet her eyes. Elvie, leaning on her cane, was ashen. She looked directly into Teresa's eyes, and Teresa stared back. It was the frogs, Teresa lied. It came easily. Between not eating first and cutting them up, I got lightheaded. Maybe, Klein said. But if there is an underlying gastrointestinal issue, we should get on it quickly. There's some microbial life on Laconia that we're seeing fungal model infections with. It's not something to take lightly. It's not what's going on, I promise, Teresa said. And then, could I talk to Dr. Okoye for a minute? There was a moment's hesitation that she couldn't quite read, like Klein might refuse. But then, of course. He nodded to Elvie. Major, he said, and walked away. When he was out of earshot, Teresa whispered, her voice harsh. What are you doing bringing him into this? We're not supposed to be around other people. Dr. Cortázar is my doctor. He's not a physician, Elvie said. His doctorate's in nanoinformatics. He shouldn't be practicing medicine any more than I should. But he knows what's going on. Do you want Dr. Klein asking around about why I'm under so much stress? You want him to figure it out? There was a joy to throwing all the things they'd said to her back at them. A delight in seeing Elvie flinch. She watched the woman struggle with something, and then reach a decision. Elvie sat on the end of the gurney, sighing as she took the weight off her leg. She rubbed her hand across her forehead. Listen, she said. I'm not supposed to tell you this, but you cannot trust Dr. Cortázar. I'm almost positive he intends to hurt you, maybe kill you. Then, a moment later, probably kill you. She felt a wave of vertigo, and the autodoc threw up a warning. It was just that she was hungry, that she needed water, that was all.
Teresa shook her head.
Why?
Elvie took a deep breath and spoke softly. I think to give a well-known subject to the repair drones and see what they do. He has two others. But he didn't have the kind of scans and prep work that he has with you. That and... he wants what you and your father were going to have. He wants to live forever, too. Like the frogs, Teresa thought, and fought back cruel, despairing laughter. He wants to treat me just like the frogs. Nature eats babies all the time. Holden had known, too. He'd tried to tell her. That was two different people who'd warned her. Two different people who'd discovered the same thing. Elvie was holding her hand, the one that didn't have a needle in it. I've been trying to keep him away from you, Elvie said, but Cortázar's very important. Without him, your father's recovery gets a lot harder. Everything gets a lot harder. We have to tell Trejo, Teresa said. He knows, Elvie said, her voice dark. I told him. We're doing what we can. But you should know, too. You should protect yourself. How? Elvie started to say something, stopped, started again. There were tears in her eyes, but her voice was steady. I don't know. I'm in over my head here. Yeah, Teresa said. Me too.
Chapter 37. Alex.
You should rest, Casper said. How many double shifts are you now?
I don't know, Alex said, leaning his back against the galley bulkhead. But I can't see that one more is going to kill me.
Isn't until it is, Casper said. But that's not even all of it. As hard as you've been working, you're going to start making mistakes.
Alex scowled at the boy. He knew Casper hadn't meant it as an insult. Knowing was what kept him from being angry, or from showing it, at least.
When you catch me screwing up, I'll stop taking doubles, Alex said. Until then...
Casper raised his hands in surrender, and Alex went back to his meal. Textured yeast paste and a bulb of water. It was his lunch if he was second shift, breakfast if he was third, so in a sense it was both. The storm had burned hard to get away from Laconian forces, but no one had chased it. No one dared to. To judge from the news feeds, most people weren't sure what they'd done to kill the Tempest, and no one wanted to risk that they'd do it again. Which was just as well, because the more they pushed, the clearer it was how much the victory had compromised them. Every shift found new, unexpected degradations in the storm. Vacuum channels that weren't transmitting power, regenerative plating that had stopped regenerating, atmosphere leaks so subtle that they couldn't be located except as the slow and steady loss of pressure. Alex was no engineer, but he'd been on the storm as long as any of them, and in space since well before many of them had been born. When he wasn't sleeping, he was working to keep the ship together. He stopped when exhaustion promised a fast, deep, and dreamless sleep. It wasn't the first time he'd used work to keep his emotions at bay. On and off his whole life, there had been times like this when the danger of feeling what he felt was too much to face. Some people got drunk, or got in fights, or hit the gym until they collapsed. He'd done all those things, too. But with the storm as beat up as it was, and the crew as injured and sick as many still were, this was fine. It kept him busy, and it kept the ship alive. Even so, it was imperfect. He knew he wasn't healed, and he suspected he wasn't even healing. The pain came in odd moments, when he was just waking up or going to sleep, and his mind wandered. Then, sure, but also when he was crawling through the access spaces looking for a broken line, or at the medical bay getting his daily ration of medication to keep the lining of his gut from sloughing off again. It would sneak up on him, and for a few seconds he'd be lost in his own mind and the oceanic sorrow there. It was about Bobby, of course, but it spilled over. In his worst moments, he also found himself thinking about Kit's upcoming marriage, about Holden and that terrible last run they'd had together on Medina when he'd been captured. Talissa, his first wife, and Giselle, his second one. Amos, who was the worst loss in this because he'd just vanished into the enemy lines. Alex might never know what had happened to him. All the families he'd had, and all the ways he'd lost them. It felt like too much to bear, but he bore it, and after a few minutes the worst would pass and he could get back to work. The passage through the ring gates into Freehold System went as well as they could have hoped. Alex let Casper do the heavy lifting. It was going to be his job soon enough, and it was better that he get the practice. They came in hot, bent their trajectory hard for the Freehold gate, and shot back out into normal space. In theory, it was possible to hit a gate from the real space side at the perfect angle and make the transit through the intervening space in a straight line. In practice, there was usually a little flex, but Casper did a good job. As good as Alex could have managed. They threw a fast torpedo at the only thing that looked like a Laconian sensor array, blowing it to dust before they made their last course correction. It was as close to anonymity as they could ask without the shell game. Freehold itself was a straightforward little system. The one habitable planet was a little smaller than Mars, then a slightly larger one farther out with an unwelcoming atmosphere, and a series of three gas giants protecting the inner system. The Storm's home port was there, in the shadow of the giant they called Big Brother when they were being polite, and Big Fucker when they weren't. It was a fraction larger than Jupiter back in Sol, with a blue-green swirling atmosphere and constant electrical storms that created arcs of lightning longer than the Earth was wide. Alex watched it grow close on the storm scopes, saw the black dot against it that was the rocky moon where they hid. Long-dead volcanism had left lava tubes big enough to land the storm and a small fleet like her under the lunar surface, and that's where they were headed, toward the permanent base of Belter engineers and underground operatives that Bobby had called the pit crew. The knock at his cabin door was polite, even tentative. Casper stayed in the corridor, braced with a handhold. "Hey," the boy said, "you coming?" "Where to?" Alex asked. "Bridge. You gotta take us in, yeah? Tradition. A pilot retires, he takes himself to the last port." "What kind of tradition is that?" Alex said with a chuckle. "I've never heard of it before." "Made it up," Casper said, "just now. Can't turn that down. Start your own tradition." "You can take us in," Alex said. "You need the practice anyway." "No," Casper said. "It's you or we just plow the fucking thing into the moon and call it done." "You're a shit liar," Alex said, but unbuckled himself from his crash couch all the same. "You should work on that." "Just like everything else," Casper said. And then, "You're really going?" "Yep," Alex said, "I really am." "You are good. You will be. You don't need me here." He drifted out of his cabin, the light G of the braking burn making down a strong suggestion more than a real weight. He headed for the central lift and up to the bridge. As he floated into it for the last time, the rest of the crew braced their feet to stand at attention. Casper, behind him, began to clap, and the others joined in. By the time Alex reached the pilot station, his eyes were damp enough to obscure his display.
"On your order, Captain," he said.
"Bring us in, Mr. Kamal," Gillian said. The actual landing was easy, from a technical perspective. Even as injured as it was, the storm knew where the walls around it were, and where the incrustation of human structures would be. Alex felt a great weight falling away from his heart. The custom docking clamps they'd made back when the Storm was a recently captured prize of war slid home with something between a sound too low to hear and a shudder.
"Welcome back, Riziad,"
the belter-inflected voice said over the comms. "Looks like you fucked up your ship pretty good."
"It'll give you lazy fuckers something to do," Jillian said, the way Bobby would have, same inflection and all.
It seemed right, in a way Alex couldn't quite describe, that the girl had paid so much attention to how Bobby ran things. Even when they were gone, the next generation up would keep echoes of them. The shuttle to Freehold was a single-hulled transport called the Drybeck. It had begun its life as an ore hauler and had been retrofitted sometime in the last 20 years. The company that had owned it had a color scheme of green and yellow, and the ghost of its logo still haunted the bulkheads on the bridge. Its drive was small and touchy, prone to stutter when the burn changed and limited by a tiny reaction mass tank. The hold was lined with crash couches, and the half-dozen of the crew most compromised by the death of the Tempest were coming home more as cargo than companions. The long fall down from the gas giants passed through the area that would have been the most trafficked space in Sol System. Hundreds of ships would have moved between Saturn and Jupiter and the inner planets. Maybe half a dozen did the same in Freehold. Alex plotted the course with a growing sense of the emptiness of the system that mere decades couldn't fill. It was too big. All of it was too big. He'd been there from the beginning, been part of blazing humanity's trail to the stars, and he still couldn't quite get his mind around how vast the spaces were. He was surprised when, a few minutes before departure, Jillian came to the little bridge and sat on the couch beside his without buckling in.
"You coming down with us?" Alex asked.
Jillian looked at him for a long moment without speaking. She looked older than he thought of her as being, as if taking command, even for so short a time as this, had aged her.
"No," she said. "The family wants to see me, and I'd like to see them too, but there'll be time for that when the war's over."
"I admire your optimism,"
Alex almost said, but the darkness was too much. He didn't want to bring her down with his own skepticism. Instead, he nodded and made a noncommittal sound in the back of his throat.
"There's a fast crawler waiting for you in port," she said. "It's got enough water, fuel, and starter yeast to get you going."
"That's good of you. I appreciate it."
"It's not altruism. Your ship," she said. "It's old, but it's a gunship. Still better than most of what the underground has burning out there."
"Maybe,"
Alex said.
"It could also be a nest for whatever birds live in the desert down there. That's part of what I'm going to find out."
"When you do, you reach out. The only people who fly solo are slingshotters and assholes. You gotta have someone with your back."
The comms clicked up. The shuttle was clear to leave. All Alex had to do was respond. He put the message on hold.
"What are you saying?" he asked.
"We're not done," Jillian said. "Not just that. We're winning. Underground is going to need every ship it can get, and yours would be a good one to have on the team. If you need a crew for her, you tell me. I'll get you one."
Alex didn't know what to say. The truth was, he didn't have a plan except to get back to the Rocinante. But she was right. There was going to be an after. An after Bobby, an after Amos, an after Holden. Whatever he was doing, he wasn't going out there to die. Just to recover.
"I'll let you know what it looks like," he said. "We'll make a plan."
Jillian stood and held out her hand. He shook it without unstrapping.
"It's been good," Jillian said. "We've done good work."
"We have, haven't we?"
Alex said. After she left, he went through one last systems check. Flying single-hulled ships was a kind of gambling he usually avoided, But even if he hit a micrometeorite, they'd probably survive it. Anyway, life was risk. He flipped the comms back on.
This is Drybeck, he said. I'm confirming clearance to launch.
You're still clear, Drybeck, the voice on the other end of the connection said.
Not blowing nothing up, and no one floating out there to run into. Gekon got, yeah? Draper Station out.
Draper Station, Alex thought as he eased the ship through the lava tube on its maneuvering thrusters. It was the first time he'd heard it called that. He didn't hate the sound. Freehold, like most Goldilocks zone planets, had a wide variety of environments. Freehold's salt deserts were on the same continent as the lush mountains he'd hidden in when they first came, and the township that had grown to be a modest city. White dunes and mesas of red stone stretched from horizon to horizon. Tent rocks rose in some places, and knife-thick ridges that could have been artifacts of alien civilizations or just beautiful geology. The dawns were warm pink, and the sunsets were green and gold. Alex didn't know why. At night, the desert sang, high, fluting tones as the temperature shift made the sand itself ring like a wine glass. The fast crawler was mostly autonomous, and it took its navigation from the time and the position of the sun, like an ancient sea captain on Earth. There was no signal coming in or going out that would give Alex's position away. The transport's wide titanium and rubber treads made the trackless Badlands easier to cover than the simplest flight in a ship. The solitude was vast and consoling. He'd expected to feel lonely on the trip, but he wasn't. The effort of being okay around the crew of the Storm had, it turned out, been exhausting. He hadn't even known he was making the effort until he didn't have to anymore. He slept in the little bunk in the crawler's belly and spent his days sitting on top of the machine, watching the sun and sky and stars, and didn't even listen to the music he'd brought with him. Twice, huge, shambling animals with legs like slender trees and coats like yellow moss had walked with him for a while. The second had been with him almost half a day before it cooed three times and turned away. As far as he knew, he was the only human being who'd ever seen them. He'd wondered more than once why Naomi had chosen to live in a hidden shipping container, but now, here, he thought he understood. The pleasure of being utterly alone made his mourning into something different and strange and humane. The cave where they'd put the Rosie was in the western quarter of the desert. He'd picked it because it was near a patchwork of radioactive ore that added a little camouflage if the enemy was looking for it, and acted as a landmark for him. The fears that haunted him now were that the Rosie wouldn't be waiting for him, that the shelf he'd parked her under had collapsed in his absence, or that the sealants they'd put on to protect the hull plating had broken down or been compromised by desert animals, exposing a ship built for vacuum to the erosion of wind and sand and salt. As the hours fell away, his anxiety started to grow. The peace of the desert rolled past until the crawler reached the edge of its automatic course and came to a shuddering halt beside a vast outcropping of stone. Alex took a flask of water and a cloth to tie across his mouth and dropped to the salt-rich sand. The shade under the stone was cool. He followed the tracks of glass where the Rosie's thrusters had melted the sand. It felt like lifetimes before. And there, dark and quiet and perfectly intact at the back of the cavern, was the old Martian corvette. Something had scratched at the sealant, maybe animals, maybe the sand-blasting desert wind, but nothing had broken through. It was just his imagination that made him feel like the ship was welcoming him. He knew that. It didn't matter. It took the better part of a day to cut through the sealing coat and get the airlock answering him, but after that things moved faster. They'd drained the water out of the tanks before they left, but the crawler's supplies were enough to get the ship almost halfway to capacity. Getting the recycling system back online was harder. He spent half a day checking feed lines before he found the one that had split, and it took another half day to replace it. It would have taken Naomi or Amos or Clarissa half an hour. He didn't sleep in the crawler anymore, especially once the Rosie's galley was able to turn out a little food. With his limited supplies, the food was Spartan, and the drinks were water and green tea. The ship was lying belly down on the ground. Everything was at 90 degrees from where his mind wanted it to be, and he had to climb to get to his cabin and his crash couch. Lost as he was in the work of hauling his old ship back to herself, he could almost pretend he was waiting for his old crew. That they'd be there in the machine shop and the flight deck, laughing and arguing and rolling their eyes like they had before. A week into the effort, he'd exhausted himself and fallen onto his couch without eating dinner. He found himself slipping between dreams and wakefulness, hearing their voices in the hallway, Clarissa's dry whisper, and Holden's earnest concern, like they were really there. And if he just concentrated, he'd be able to make out the words. The alert tone, as the airlock opened and familiar footsteps in the halls. When the silhouette bent into his doorway, he still thought he was dreaming. It was the sound of a living voice, the first since he'd left Freehold, that brought him back to himself. "Hey," Naomi said. Chapter 38. Naomi. "Hey," Naomi said. Alex shifted in his crash couch, and the hiss of the gimbals was like something made from memory. He blinked at her, confused and sleep-drunk.
"No shit," he said.
"No shit," Naomi said.
No, I didn't know you were coming."
They were simple words, commonplace. They carried a heavy weight. Time and tragedy had thinned Alex's face and darkened the skin under his eyes. His smile was joyful, but it was a bruised kind of joy. The pleasure and delight that could only come to someone who understood how precious they were and how fragile. She figured that she looked the same.
"I got your message about heading back here, and, well, I had some other plans, but the more I thought about it, the more sense coming back to the Rosie made."
"Thought about it a lot, eh?"
10, maybe 15 whole seconds," she said. Alex barked out a laugh and hauled himself up. She stepped into the cabin and they embraced. The last time they'd touched had been on the deep transfer station back in Seoul. There had been 3 of them. After a moment, they stepped back. She was surprised by how good it felt to see Alex in the familiar environment of the Rosinante, even if the ship was 90 degrees from her usual orientation.
"How'd you get here?"
he asked, still grinning.
"I have a cracker box with an Epstein," Naomi said. "From Oberon to here. It's not rated for atmosphere, though, so I parked it at the transfer station and hitched her lift down on a shuttle.
Planet side again.
And my knees already hate it. But I'm in a ship, so it's not too strange," she said.
"You're never going to convince me that this whole sky thing isn't fucking creepy. I like my air held in by something I can see, thank you very much."
"You want a drink? The old girl's not all the way up to snuff, but she can make you some tea. Maybe even some mate by now, depending on how the recyclers are doing."
"I wouldn't say no," Naomi said. And then, because it felt stranger to leave it unsaid than to say it, "I am so sorry about Bobby. I cried for a whole day."
Alex looked down and away. His smile shifted invisibly into a mask of itself.
"I still do sometimes.
It'll take me by surprise, and it's like it's happening again for the first time, he said.
Thinking about Jim does that to me.
You should have seen her, Exo,
Alex said, and he did something between a laugh and a